The Last Resort Podcast with Jesse Case.
Podcast time. Who's pumped? Walter, welcome back, buddy.
Welcome back, Jesse.
Thanks, man. It's very good to be back in our home. We got the laundry going.
Groceries.
Sure. This is good. This is good. Back in the old bed.
So comfy.
I'm excited about it. Well, Walter and I have had a pretty crazy,
insane
2 months. It hasn't been easy. There have been a lot of issues going on, personally, you know, with my family and health, and my dad is like blind in one eye now. It's a long, stressful story.
Pirate shit, man.
That I'm not going to get into because it's none of your fucking business. But we're back, okay? So here's the deal. Starting over, starting anew. This podcast, the first of many that I hope you listen to and I hope you enjoy. They are going to be weekly now. I've carved out, I'm sort of in a point now in Los Angeles, took a little while to get to, where I can carve out a day. I carve out a podcast day. So I'm going to be recording podcasts on Fridays and, going to be uploading them probably in the middle of the night, between Friday and Saturday. And then Saturday morning, you'll have one ready for you. You wake up, you got your pajamas on. You're eating your Captain Crunch, watching cartoons to take you back to a time before you were scared of everything, and just pop it on mute. You know, listen to the podcast, so you can subconsciously take in the acid frenzy racism of the old Walt Disney cartoons while you're listening to the podcast. So I'd like to welcome any new listeners.
Welcome.
I think I might have a few because we're having a pretty big interview today. We have Mark Maron on. And I'm going to try to tie this into where we've been, Walter.
Do it, man.
Right, because I didn't realize how big of a deal Mark Maron was until very recently. I just sort of thought he was a guy that I see sometimes.
You were wrong.
Now, I was wrong, and I have nothing but the utmost respect for Mark. His comedy, I feel, is very relevant and refreshing, and I think he's a really smart guy, as you'll be able to hear in the interview. Now, I'd only heard of Mark about a month before I moved to Los Angeles. I was listening to some other podcast, Adam Carolla or somebody, and I heard him on there being interviewed. I really liked it, and then my iTunes sort of thing, it linked me to his podcast, the now taking over the world WTF. And I really liked that. And then I bought his albums and I listened to those on the road trip out. When I was driving out to LA with my stuff. So, and then I think the second day in town, I saw him. I ran into him at the Improv or something. We were introduced through a mutual friend. And then I just kept bumping into him like every night for 2 weeks. Which I'm sure he was probably a bit creeped out by, but we're in very, very similar circles. Of acquaintances. But this whole time, I still thought of him as sort of perhaps a hidden gem within the comedy community. The public, maybe they weren't so hip to it, and I didn't really understand the deal. I got an email from him this morning. You know, when he had posted in the podcast. And I wrote back, soon. He's like, well, you kind of pestered me to do it. And I, of course, didn't mean to seem pestering, but I guess I had no idea how busy he is. He's a big deal, this Mark Maron. And that didn't occur to me, really, because I'm a narcissistic fuck, which, Mark and I are going to talk about because we share that together. So Here's how this all happened. This interview was recorded a little while ago. It was recorded before I left to go to go on the road. I went to the Montreal Comedy Festival, the Just for Laughs, the Juste pour Rire, and it was awesome.
We had fun.
Yeah, it was a great time, man.
Bicycles everywhere.
Yeah, you can rent bicycles in Montreal. I've never been to that city. It's a really, really nice city, and really nice people, and a really fun festival to do. It was a big honor for me. I don't know about what it'll do for my career, you know, anymore or whatever, but artistically validating, I feel. And this interview was recorded right before I left for the festival. So I'm putting this out there, and you can definitely hear this during the interview. I think Marc Maron thinks I'm much more fucked up than I am. I think that's fair to say. I think he thinks I'm a psycho.
Totally.
Which I do understand, based on any first impression of me, and also based on the headspace I was in at the time. It's pretty interesting. You know, my audition for this festival, this Montreal festival, was the day I moved to L.A. It was that night. And then, you know, I got the call back. Then I found out I got it. And this all happened in the course of, I don't know, 4 weeks or something. And I didn't have stuff unpacked. You know, no friends in town. You know, new kid on the block, whatever. And it was just a stressful time, man. You know, getting ready for this big, you know, thing that's been crammed down your throat since you start doing comedy. Dude, you got to do the Montreal Festival. It's the, oh, man, once you do that, like, whatever. But, you know, so I was scared shitless about it and with no moral support because you're not allowed to tell anybody. You know, I told my parents, but they don't do comedy. They don't really get it.
You were really nervous.
But I was just flipping out, man, flipping out. And then you get there, you realize, that, you know, who gives a fuck? It's just you're just doing shows. You know, but these things, they build up in your head. And as a comedian, they don't just build up in your head since the time you found out you've got it, since you're doing the festival or whatever. You know, they build up in your head since you've been starting comedy, since you started. So it's the same, you know, you do your first Tonight Show or something like that. It's the amount of pressure you put on yourself is insane, and it doesn't fucking matter. It's just another set. It doesn't matter. Nothing makes or breaks a comic anymore. No one move. You know, you have to stay consistent. It's, you know, as they say, it's a marathon, not a sprint. But obviously, I was getting my first case of the L.A. slumps. And, yeah, so I think Mark thinks I'm pretty fucked up as a person. Every time he sees me, he says, hey, cheer up, man. I'm like, well, I'm fine. You know, I'm fine. Right?
I guess, man.
Yeah. I'm a normal dude. Sure, from time to time, I forget to put on deodorant before I go out because I'm busy thinking about things. And sure, I signed up for Facebook just to apologize to people I went to high school with for being a dick. And sure, I can only come when Wagner's playing.
That's fucked up.
And sure, I threw out my back one time trying to perform auto fellatio and Walter had to take me to the hospital.
Weird night.
It's a fucked up night, man. But aside from these things, I mean, I'm quite standard. I'm quite a bog standard. I'm a bog standard fella. Did anyone else do that? Did anyone else sign up for Facebook just to apologize to people that they went to school with for being being an adolescent dick? Ah, man. I was such a dick. And especially, I mean, I've been thinking about this stuff recently because I just drove across a country. And I've driven across the U.S. probably 10 times back and forth on, you know, 90 all the way down to the 10. By the time you get done with one of those trips, you're so incredibly in your head. If you're anything like me, when you get in your head, eventually it's going to turn into shit I feel guilty about. And I think I first signed up, actually, for Facebook after I'd already been doing stand-up, and it was after, like, a road trip that I did. I was doing, like, a little road run or something, but there was this one stretch of it where I had to drive for 12 hours, and by the end of it, I was like, I think I've hurt everyone I've come in contact with.
You were a dick.
But yeah, man, I just feel terrible on those road trips, and that's why I signed up for Facebook. Jesus. Fucking stolen money from my parents. I tell people that too, and they're like, "Everybody's done that, man. You know, you steal a 20 from their dresser or something. Oh man, yeah, it's terrible." And it's like, no, man. Like there was a comma involved. Like I've stolen money from my parents.
Dude,
can't believe they still talk to me. Jesus, I need some ice cream.
Ice cream, let's do it.
I should switch to frozen yogurt, though. You know, is there any fucking difference? Is frozen yogurt, is it ice cream parading as healthy?
I don't know, man.
Is frozen yogurt just ice cream wearing a tracksuit?
Maybe so.
These are questions I have. And who's got the answers? Mark Maron. That's who.
Terrible segue.
I know, it's fucking terrible. We need to change the name of this podcast to Sidetracked.
Totally.
Next week is the Montreal episode, okay? So I just want to go ahead and let you know that we're going to talk about the festival, and I did some interviews and some conversations with my fellow fresh faces, new faces. I already forgot the name of the fucking show I did. I really did. Anyway, I did some interviews with those guys, and we sat around and we talked, and some very, very bright young comedians. So that's going to be cool. I hope you tune back in for that. And then after that, I've got the week following, I'm going to have an interview with Andy Wood, who is a co-founder of the Bridgetown Comedy Festival, one of my favorite festivals to do in Portland, Oregon.
Portland is awesome.
So let's get into this interview. I took Mark over a book of Beatles guitar chords because we're both Beatle freaks. In exchange, he gave me a copy of his book, The Jerusalem Syndrome, which I want to recommend to you guys. I read it, and it's extremely funny and endearing. And I think people that dig this thing will dig that. So he and Walter did not get along. He did not like Walter sitting in on the interview. But aside from that, things went well. Get into it. Also, the WTF podcast, that's twice weekly because he's professional and shit. All right, everybody. Mark Maron.
Doesn't have a point of view, knows not where he's going to. Isn't he a bit like you?
Are we good on the computer? You still stare. What are you doing?
No, it's good. It's good. You're not going to have two tracks to work with.
That's fine. That's fine, man. I'm not big on the interview editing process.
Okay.
We keep it real.
We keep it real.
So you're born in New Mexico.
New Jersey.
What the fuck?
Do some research, Jesse.
I thought you were born in New Mexico.
I grew up in New Mexico.
When did you move to New Mexico? When did you guys move to New Mexico?
My family, both my parents were from Jersey. And and then when I was about six, my dad moved to Alaska with my family. My mom and dad moved to Alaska because he was in the service.
Okay.
We were in Alaska for 2 years. And then, a friend of his set up a practice in New Mexico. And he said, I'm going to go there, too. Looks like a boom town. And we ended up in Albuquerque, 1971, 72.
How old are you?
I am 46.
Okay.
So I think I started third grade through high school. I lived in New Mexico.
When did you start doing stand-up?
I started doing stand-up. The first time I got on stage as a stand-up, I was in college. It was probably 1983 or 84. And then I was in a team thing with a guy. And we wrote some sketches, auditioned for a TV show for Catch a Rising Star. We did a team thing, and that didn't work out. And then I tried to go solo in 84, and I became a horrendous drunk doing open mics in Boston. And then I sort of put it in the can until I graduated in 87. Then I right after college, I moved to Hollywood and became a doorman at the Comedy Store. So legitimately speaking, I have not worked a regular job since 1988. After doing stand-up 2 years, I came in second in a contest in Boston and started working as a stand-up after that.
So you went to Boston solely for college?
Yes.
Where'd you go?
Boston University.
What'd you major in, Mark?
English literature, and I minored in film studies.
Have you done anything with that? I mean, do you make film? Do you want to make film?
Sure. I wrote a movie once with another guy.
Okay.
But didn't go anywhere. I don't really actively want to make film. Film studies was more of it was actually an art history major. It was more film criticism.
All right.
It was a lot of that, but I've been pitching around this animated short.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
It's called Bukkake Circus.
Yeah. You told me about that.
Yeah.
Or we've talked about that.
Yeah.
I got a great animator.
Do you want me to pitch it to you?
I've heard you do it. All of my listeners listen to your podcast.
Did I pitch it on there?
Pitch it. Yeah, do it.
No, I'm not going to do it.
No, Mark, if you need to do it.
It's not a real one. I mean, I'd like to see it. I think it'd be funny. You have a good animator? Can we do it?
Yeah, we'll do it. All right. Emailed you before. You didn't email him back.
What the fuck? Are you serious?
Yeah. We were in Portland. You know, we were both at that festival. And he was there. And so he came down and we were hanging out.
Oh, right.
And then, you know, but then, I don't know, I saw you on the street or something, and he was with me, and then you walked up, and he's like, you know Marc Maron? And I was like, yeah, a little. He doesn't like me, you know.
I think you're overstating it. It's not that I don't like you. You're just annoying. And that's part of being a comedian, and I appreciate it.
Okay.
You're persistent and annoying, but, you know, you don't lack charm, and you're funny, and you remind me of me, which means that you sort of honor my narcissistic thing.
Right, but it also means that we wouldn't have gotten along. See, that's the thing that I find mind-blowing, is when I meet people that remind me of me when I was younger,
mm-hmm.
or when I remind people, you never would have gotten along with them at the time. Because when you were 24, which is where I'm at now,
fucking old.
Had I known you when you were 24, and I'm still 24, some sort of time machine scenario,
yeah,
we wouldn't have been friends.
No, but I'm willing to bet that you don't have that many friends. For real. Like, you spend a lot of time alone.
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So really, it wouldn't have been relative to me or anybody else. You're just that kind of guy.
It would have been my deal. Yeah, no, I realize that.
It's hard for you to maintain friendships because it's impossible for you not to get jealous and think less of yourself depending on the person. So it'd have to be a pretty fucked up person to really be your friend. Like, you know, maybe in a wheelchair or somebody who is missing some part of their brain.
Jesus Christ, man.
Okay. All right.
Am I wrong?
I feel like a lot of my friends are pretty stable, but I feel like that's a thing that that I'm attracted to, because like you, I'm a crazy magnet, where crazy people they flock to me nonstop every day.
Do you know why?
Barrage of crazy people.
I feel bad I said person in a wheelchair fucked up. I didn't mean fucked up in any other way than they're slightly compromised because they can't walk.
Right. Well, I'm glad you're worried about offending the listeners, not me.
I don't know. It's so easy. You're too easy to offend.
I look up to you as a comedian, so I'm very sensitive around it. You know, we'll get to that level where I'll give you shit.
What do you mean you just did it in my kitchen? I mean, just like out of nowhere, pow, load of shit, bang, bam.
I understand you get it. It's a blanket thing.
Sure,
yeah,
sure.
All right. Sure.
I can take that. You didn't overstep any lines.
I didn't think I did. You know,
but you knew it was a gamble. You know, you're rolling the dice. You know?
I was rolling the dice. I drove over here. I had some lines piled up.
Yeah.
I had some shit going. I was like, you know what? I'm going to give him this book.
Yeah.
He's going to sit it on the kitchen. Yeah. Sit it on the kitchen
table.
I'll play
those songs. I appreciate the book. I play my guitar all the time, and having a Beatles book in the kitchen means it'll get to the living room, which is where my
it'll eventually migrate to the living room.
And my acoustic guitar is in the living room, and I will be playing songs from the book you gave me.
Now,
getting back to crazy people, why do you think you attract crazy people? Because I know why I attract crazy people.
Well, it's because I grew up around it, and I'm tolerant of it.
Bing, 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 bing.
Yeah, it's
you the, understand them.
They, yeah. Well, they
you are designed them. To adapt to their crazy.
Right, and there's a thing where, I mean, some people, sometimes you can make eye contact with someone and realize immediately you shouldn't have done that.
Oh, yeah.
And because they're in. That yeah. lets them in.
And they know that.
And they know it. Know
that. But it wouldn't happen to other people.
You think so?
No, not some people see crazy people, and there's never a question of in or out. They're like, that's crazy. But with us, you know, you feel the gateway open. Like, if you lock eyes with a crazy
right.
person, and they lock eyes with you, it's already done.
Yeah.
You both sense the doorway.
Yeah.
And now you're literally, you have to run.
You're going to know them. Yeah. You're going to know them now.
Or no, you have to really consciously go, no,
right.
no.
Right. I was at a coffee place the other day, and there was a woman with she was missing one leg, so and she had no teeth, and she kept talking about how, you know, the aliens were trying to kill her, which I understand, you know, sure, but she had the thing that I couldn't handle was since we were talking about the disabled earlier, you know, all that fine with it, but I'd never actually seen this in use before. She had a cup of the fake saliva because she can't produce saliva.
Oh, yeah, you said that like as a general thing we should all understand. But
well, no, people do that. Some okay. people can't produce saliva.
No, I didn't know that, yeah.
So they have, you can buy like fake saliva
yeah.
at Walgreens or whatever. Yeah. And it's a mix. You mix it in with your water. But it's spit, basically. Mm-hmm. And she just had a cup of, and she kept, you know, and it was poor adolescent. And, yeah. you know, I wasn't ready. I wasn't ready for that.
Yeah, it's a lot to take.
It was a
on
lot.
On top of the no teeth.
It
no
was
leg.
A lot at once.
Yeah.
And then she was a cat lady. She talked to me about her cats.
Yeah.
A lot of photos of the cats. But she gave me your phone number. She wound up giving me your phone number, and she said, we'll meet. And we're not going to meet.
Well, that's good for you. I imagine that had the appearance been different, I bet you even if she had both legs and teeth, but still the saliva cup and the cat picture.
The saliva cup was a deal breaker. That would have, it doesn't matter.
Not the no teeth and the leg thing.
The no teeth and the leg thing, I still don't know about the meat. Because it was, there's a certain level where maybe she couldn't help that. Mm-hmm. Maybe some sort of, maybe she's sober now. She used to be really into meth. Maybe she some sort of stepped on a landmine when she was helping out Diana in the landmine situation. I don't know.
That's a better story. The meth thing, maybe both. And then you have a real sort of.
Well, like, that's what I mean. Because feel like Diana was pre-meth.
Mm-hmm.
But then, and that's her deal, and now she's hanging out at a coffee shop.
But the saliva thing was just, you can't even put a backstory behind that, can you?
Too much.
Yeah.
Too much.
It's like, I can't even make something up that would explain that.
Even though that's the only disability about her that is clearly not her fault. That's a born, I don't think you can make yourself not have salival glands.
No, I think that's true, unless she had them removed for some reason. That would take a lot of work, because there's a lot of them.
Aliens.
The aliens took her saliva glands.
Is her,
and her leg, and perhaps her teeth to build someone like her. That's a better story all around.
Yeah.
Is that they were building somebody exactly like her, and they wanted to make sure that they could eat properly and masticate their food and keep their mouth moist on top of having the proper legs and teeth.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think you should call her, or at least contact her.
I should.
This might be your ticket out, Jess.
Ticket out of what?
I don't know. She might be in touch with the aliens. You might be a big star wherever they are. Maybe they... Maybe they like self-loathing people that are constantly doubting themselves and hyper-cynical out of their own insecurity. Maybe you're like a hero in that world.
Maybe. This is good. This is good for me.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me, buddy.
Yeah. I think you're having me, actually.
We're at your place. It's weird because it's my podcast, but you're the host. You know what I mean?
I'm not hosting. I'm following your lead.
I don't know what I'm doing. There's no cue cards here. There's no index. We're having a conversation.
It's a fucking robot.
Right.
Fuck off.
Okay, Walter.
When's he gonna shut up?
Grindy dicks.
I mean, I do podcasts, and I've had people over here to do podcasts. That's nice that the robot lights your cigarette too. I see the relationship.
Yeah,
but no one has ever brought a fucking robot to my house.
I was
cool with it at first, and now it's a little disconcerting because he's a dick.
Mark's a dick.
What's to say it can't feel, or it can't?
The fact that it doesn't have salivary glands, and so it probably can't cry.
That hurts.
Maybe you should hook your robot up with that chick that you met at the coffee shop.
That's a good call.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good call. He is a virgin.
Oh, look at him. Like, yeah, try to pretend like you're not, Walter.
It's true.
Walter's getting it hard today.
Fuck off.
So you, all right, Mark. Let's. I'm not as adept a podcaster as you. I'm not good at this.
But you told me you had audio engineering, so you're certainly adept at more than
the producing. No, the producing end. It's crisp. It sounds great.
Mm-hmm.
But what is sounding great is generally not that substantial.
Uh huh.
That's how it works. You're playing with a nail.
It's just a nail that I have. We're out in my garage.
I know, but I feel like that's some sort of thing. Like that's like, oh,
I'm sorry,
fuck,
he's fidgeting.
No, like exactly.
Okay,
it's like, all right, no, he's going to the nail. Fuck, I fucked up. I got to get him back. He's going to the nail.
See, now this is good podcasting. All right, get me back.
There's no way.
I'm back, man.
I never had you, buddy.
Of course you did. I'm completely engaged. We've got to get you out of your head, Jess, and that'll determine whether or not your podcast is visceral to people.
Well, you're okay. Let's talk about, I want to talk about your podcast.
Okay.
You've gotten a lot of success from this thing. You're always on the iTunes top download comedy section thing. Now it seems, the what the fuckers, they're coming out to shows, they're bringing you gifts, they're showering you with gifts.
Yeah.
What
baked goods?
A lot of baked goods.
Cat toys.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. A lot of things like that. Mm. Now I know you did Air America for a while.
Yeah.
I mean, how'd you get your podcast off the boards?
I have no idea, really. I mean, what happened was, you know, I didn't want to be back at Air America the last time I went back, but we were there, and it was a new leadership, and it was already in trouble from day one. And I've been working with my producer, Brendan McDonald, who's a wizard, you know, for years. He produced me on morning radio. He produced a radio show I did out here. He produced the internet TV show we did. And I love working with him, and I trust him, implicitly. And after we were getting fired again from Air America, I was like, well, let's do something. you know, let's do a radio show. And it's like, who the fuck wants to be on terrestrial radio? What do we want to bark up that tree or try to say, you know, fuck that. Let's try a podcast. So ultimately, you know, what we were doing was we still had pass cards to Air America after we got fired. So they didn't take our security cards away. So we started going into the studio after hours and using the radio studio and bringing up my friends and talking to people and just, you know, doing a free form, you know, show built around my personality. And I've always wanted to sort of detach from extreme partisan politics radio. I never was that, you know, like that to begin with. I, you know, I'm not a political comic.
Well, yeah, you're not that, your stuff's not that topical.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, I consider it more substantial than topical.
Well, that's why I moved towards that, you know, but, you know, when you're doing daily radio and you're doing lefty radio, I mean, obviously I'm a lefty, but, it, you know, I had to be more interested than I was in the, you know, the machinations of politics and there was an issue of carrying a certain amount of water for the left. And, you know, I always fought with it. So now, you know, I could get back to my comic roots, which is more philosophical, more about, you know, broader hypocrisies and stuff. And it was just an exciting opportunity. So then we contacted iTunes. We put together the first couple shows. And at that time, which was only like, what, 7 months ago, 8 months ago, last September or whatever, you know, they were, it hadn't, you know, completely blown up yet. And iTunes was very excited about having people who were professionals, you know, do these things.
Right.
You know, because it serves them. They want people to come around to the podcast. And like, I think I brought over some listeners from Air America, but not a lot. I mean, you know, I thought maybe we'd get 1,500, couple thousand people listening to the first couple episodes.
Right.
And then we got the artwork done and iTunes got behind it and put the banner up. And I just think by virtue of, you know, a lot of different things, you know, people started coming around to it. And I can only do it one way. You know, I think and talk and engage with the mic, you know, in the only way I know. I can do bits, I can talk to other people, but it was a great opportunity for me to purely express my mind. And I don't know, you know, there's nothing other than that. You know, the success of it is relative to how I talk to people, you know, how I talk about myself to people.
Right.
And it was really just like that. There's no lightning in a jar that I can tell you the reason why it's so popular, other than it seems to be a good medium for me, and people are enjoying it.
Well, no, people certainly respond to it. Now, I've heard you talk a lot about you know, you have a lot of younger listeners.
Yeah, I love that, because like if I had this outlet, man, I mean, we had to sneak, you know, Richard Pryor records, and you know, our parents didn't know that we were listening to filth. Not that Richard was filth, but I mean, you'd have to, you know, sneak a record in. The idea that people can listen to me, especially at that age, I like it because, and I like them because, you know, I don't think adults talk like I do in the real world, and I think there's a reality to my existence that I'm sharing that they're not privy to, and I think it gives them a little comfort that, you know, whatever's being presented to them is the right way or the wrong way to be a grown up. Is maybe just a bullshit thing.
Okay. Well, I agree with that. I mean, I agree with that to a level. But what... Okay, so you think that the younger people, they're connecting with you because you're a... I guess I'm just trying to follow the thought train here. I feel like someone should walk in and feed you grapes right now, someone in a robe.
Really, here, this house?
Yeah, yeah. I feel that I connect with him and speak in a, you know, I identify with the younger generation. And
I don't think I was saying it like that. What I'm saying is that, you know, the things that go on in my mind about feeling out of place, about feeling angry, about feeling, you know, existentially challenged by what's expected of me or how the world functions are really adolescent feelings. You know, in that adolescence in and of itself is the most awkward time in your life that you have no control over. It's just by virtue of your place in life at that time that all those feelings exist. So I think that hearing a grown up experiencing the same thing is somewhat hopeful and comforting. It's not that like I want to be this way for the rest of my life, but that it is not just, you know, my lot in life as a kid, and that maybe it goes away, or maybe there's a way to handle that. That's all.
Well, I've always connected with that in the sense that I agree. I don't think I really matured. You just gain more wisdom. You go through more experiences, but my sense of frustration, isolation, all that, it's the very same. I don't see that going away. It's kind of terrifying. But do you really think that that's different from that many adults, or do you think you're just more self-aware about it?
No. I think that. Well, you asked me specifically about the teenagers. So in terms of resonating.
Say I'm asking two questions.
Well, in terms of resonating with adults around those issues, I think that as an adult and also the same way that as a teenager, that you have to do what's necessary to keep your job, to get the job, to treat your kids properly, to treat your spouse or significant other properly,
right.
to move through the world in an acceptable way, you know, so you can get to where you need to go on, you know, in any given situation. So I believe, yes, that a lot of these things, these you can call them neurotic or circular obsessions with the brain or the constant self-reflection, like, you know, who am I in this situation? Am I doing this right? They are part of the adult brain, but they're a part that can't be spoken to or spoken of because you're too busy trying to get by. I think it's a little different than being an adolescent because you don't know any different. When you're younger, that you think like, holy shit, this is my reality, and it's a real, you know, it's crippling. And I think as you get older, you start to realize like, I have to harness this stuff. You know, I have to process it. I can't be debilitated by it. But some adults are. I just think it's an unspoken id that people learn how to manage. And I think that when it is spoken, that they're like, oh, thank God I'm not alone. All right, so now I can go to work.
Of course.
So that's that.
Well, yeah, but life in and of itself, I mean, the day-to-day grind is, although not a pleasant one, it's still escapism, you know, from... I mean, is that kind of what you're saying? That's always how I've felt. Is okay.
It's not escapism. Certain people have the cojones or the balls to pursue things that are impractical. Most people don't. Most people need to know that they have a paycheck. Most people need to know that they have some sense of security, that they can either take care of themselves or their family. You know, most people accept this as living in the civilized world and doing what one has to do.
Right.
Is that escapism? No, it's survival and personal responsibility. Everybody makes compromises in order to get their needs met. So when you have somebody that has not done that,
right,
and is an untethered machine, an untethered mind in a world where, you know, he's risked all that to pursue this other thing.
Yeah.
There's a purity to it, but I don't think in any way that what they're doing is escapism. I think there's a lot of disappointment, and I think that because of the culture we live in, everyone is certainly a little narcissistic and a little entitled. So what they wrestle with is not like, you know, my life is a lie, but like, you know, I really wish I could have done that. I really wish I could have pursued that. I just was too afraid. And then, like, I think that in some ways I speak to the creative people in that, like, you can still do it. You just have to change your expectations around it, because sometimes just being creative or acting out on those dreams is fulfilling in its own way without being, you know, recognized as the best or or that guy's a genius,
right,
or whatever. So I think that that's the sort of conflict I'm speaking to in a lot of ways.
Right.
Well, but I don't think that their life is escapism. I think it can be sort of a slog.
Well, I just think that most day-to-day activity, I mean, of course there's the get the paycheck, there is the survival, take care of your family, feed your kids, put food on the table, there's that. But I think most things, going to a comedy show included, is to thinking about the human condition is terrifying. And I think
that's why they invented God.
It's absolutely terrifying, but I'm not okay with being on my deathbed someday and saying, oh shit, I never thought about any of it. I've avoided this tunnel my whole life, and now I'm terrified. Like, I think for some reason, if I hammer through it, I need to follow through.
No, I think what you're saying is that, look, I recently thought about this the other day, is that, you know, I've never been this busy in my life.
Okay.
And I'm fortunate to be busy doing things I want to do and that I like doing. I think that, you know, in these lives we're talking about outside of survival, there are people that like their job. There are people that find a sense of accomplishment in their job. There are people that are doing something they're good at and capable of doing.
Yeah.
It may get repetitive. It may not be exactly what they want, but there is a feeling of satisfaction, of gratification, of reward, of pride, of working with other people, of community. I mean, all that stuff is part of it too.
Right.
It's very hard to just sort of, you know, batch this stuff into a box and say that's their life and this is my life. But the one thing I do realize about being busy is time fucking flies by.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're really busy, you're like, what happened to my week? What happened to my month? What happened to my year? Whereas when you're sitting around going, you know, I'm fucked. When is my thing going to happen? How come I'm, you know, an asshole? You know, why aren't I that guy? When you're sitting there doing that, time just trickles by.
Right.
Days could not seem longer. So in a sense, you're getting more out of your life in terms of how you sense time when you're miserable.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree.
And not doing anything. But the issue about being on your deathbed and not having examined this stuff is you're probably going to be terrified on your deathbed no matter what.
Right. Right. Of course.
And I think that examination of the human condition is still relative to your perception. You know, you could see it. You know, I had a bunch of ants in here the other night, and I realized, like, you know, you human beings are going to come and go on this planet, but these fucking bugs, they're going to win, and they're very organized,
right?
And they don't give a fuck about us, and they don't even know that they have legs. You know, so, you know, who am I to think that I'm any better than them, or who am I to think that, you know, that life is worth living? You can choose to go that direction and think that the big thing, the big chaos is that, you know, like, life is meaningless. You know, I'm going to be forgotten. We're all going to die. You know, even whatever I leave here will eventually go away. You know, what's the point of it all? You can do that, or else you can say, well, maybe I can experience a little joy in my life. Maybe I can touch another person's life. Maybe I can achieve something that I'm proud of, instead of sitting in that fucking, like, it doesn't make any fucking difference. We're all fucked and I'm an idiot. I mean,
I never said that.
No, but I'm just saying that the two versions of this is that it's all relative to your perception. The bottom line is, yeah, we die, and we're probably going to be forgotten eventually anyways. You know, maybe not for 10 years, maybe, you know, maybe we'll have some world, and, you know, maybe photographs will exist, but it is all seemingly sort of ridiculous. But then what is life supposed to be? That's up for you to decide, and you can cull from whatever ideas you want. But, you know, at some point, you're probably going to want to have a little bit of happiness, a little bit of self-satisfaction, a little bit of humility, a little bit of joy. And those are things you're going to have to figure out how to have.
Right. Okay. I think you just had a conversation with yourself, and that's okay. That's okay. I do that too.
You probably did it in the monologue, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Okay. that's what we do, Mark. But I do think there's a comfort to that futility you speak of, because I think if you can get through that and be okay with that, then you're like a level 2 mage or whatever bullshit reference you want to throw out. I mean, then it's like you're free kind of to float around and have a good time.
But some people don't think about that, and they don't have to.
They don't have to.
No.
That's where we're at.
But why would they?
No, I'm not arguing. I'm saying I think that's a profound point. They don't have to.
Some people never feel sorry for themselves for very long.
Okay.
Some people don't think that they deserve everything.
don't look at me like that when
you say
that.
I'm having a conversation with you now.
I know. Well, you're having a conversation at me, and that's a step. That's a step in the right direction. I think
you keep trying to figure out a way to box it, but you know who I'm talking to.
I know. Well, when we first met, we were both having just conversations at each other. And I think we're finally getting to a point where we're talking. It's good.
I always listened to you. It's been difficult, but
really? What? Let's talk about me for a second.
Do it.
All right. You still haven't seen me do stand-up comedy. What's your impression? You said I've always felt a connection with you. But I don't feel that's that unique to me. I think a lot of people do. A lot of people feel a connection to Mark Maron.
That's a new thing, by the way. I mean,
no. That's fair enough if that's a new thing. And I feel that it's completely due credit. I have always felt like even upon listening to one of your first records, you know, that I had, I felt like I'm going to be friends with this guy at some point. We can fucking play Beatles tunes, you know, whatever. It doesn't matter.
Are we going to hang out and play guitar?
We'll hang out and play guitar.
You pretty good?
I'm all right.
Yeah, I'm not that great.
Well, you know, we'll work it out.
I can do certain things pretty
good. Okay. No, we'll hang out and play guitar. I was like, you know, he's sober.
Can we record it?
Yeah. I'm like, you know, we're sober guys. Yeah. We'll be sober.
Yeah.
You know, we'll hang out. But then, like I said, that's not unique to me. I think almost everyone that's listened to one of your albums gets that. The fact that I'm a comic and we're in similar circles, that's able to happen.
Right.
But I feel like most people that hear you and hear you talk and listen to your podcast think, I could definitely be friends with this dude.
Yeah.
That's an intangible thing That's a thing that you can't learn in a fucking Judy Carter book, you know.
Right. They are specific people. You know, there are certain people that are like, I'm not going to fucking hang out with that guy. He's draining and whiny and, you know, thinks he's overthinking everything.
But I'm an insomniac. I need to hang out with you.
No, but what I'm saying with you,
I can have a nap later, and that's...
Right. But like, when I met you, like, I do know instinctively, in the same way you attract crazy people, you know, who are like-minded people and who are kindred spirits, and I can sort of sum up in my head in a moment, you know, not your entire personality, but, you know, sort of like the thing that we do have in common. So I don't feel much distance between you and me. I see where you're coming from, and I think you're right in that we do have things to talk about, and we do have, you know, things to learn from each other, and so... Your intuition was not faulty.
But yeah, but I think no one wants to... I mean, obviously nobody wants to be defined as that one-dimensional. Like, oh, he's one of those guys. Oh, he's a comic that he's, you know...
No, I was talking about the other stuff, about, you know, the paralyzing insecurity, the cynicism, the anger, the self-doubt, the making up shit in your head to make your life difficult, the gravitation towards insanity, the compulsive behavior. Is that one thing?
Sure. All right. Well, let's get on to this tangent then. From this, and thanks for doing this, by the way. I feel like we're culminating to a...
Yeah. Well, now that the robot is shut up, everything's okay.
Yeah, it's a good call. It's a good call. I've heard you talk a lot in your podcast, and like I said, all my listeners avidly listen to your podcast. You've talked a lot about the younger generation of comedy, and how and I've heard you talk to some older comics about it. And about how it is, you know, or what is alt comedy? You know, what does that mean? The slacker sort of apathetic attitude on stage. I'm just as annoyed by these things as a member of that generation of comedy. What is it, do you think? What do you think has caused that? Do you feel... I mean, because I know in a lot of ways you are credited for starting alt comedy or being one of the pioneers of alt comedy. I've heard you say that yourself. Is that
Well, I get lumped in with something that happened in the 90s that was really just a movement out of traditional comedy venues to do more freeform stuff and to have a little more control over what we could or couldn't do because there wasn't money at stake and we were speaking to like-minded people.
Right. I've never really known what it means. Like when I'll go to alt comedy shows here in LA, to me, the alt comedy, it's the same exact formula, but it's 80s references instead of 70s references. So it's people talking about some show they used to watch on Nickelodeon. It's that generation of nostalgia as opposed to some old Bank of America commercial in the 70s or something. It's just the same observational. I think great comics that are saying real things, it's still going to... The cream will still rise to the top.
Maybe.
And it's... No, I think so. I think it's still just as hack.
It just depends on whether the person who's rising, you know, destroys himself or his wings melt before he gets...
Okay. Getting Greek on me.
Sure.
sure. In that capacity, that being said, I need to edit out all my ums.
No, you don't.
I think we're going to get on that, right?
No, it's part of you.
I don't know how to conduct an interview, though. I always wind up apologizing to the guests...
No, you're doing fine. What you're asking me is, you know, what is alt comedy?
No.
And or what is, you know, what defines it or why is it different?
No, I was trying to ask you how big your areolas were. I take a really weird way to...
They're bigger than most guys, I think.
I think above average.
Yeah, very sensitive, too. I don't know why I got girl boobs.
I have very sensitive breasts.
It's the best thing. It's a gift. Once you get the chick to cross over the line that they're actually sensitive and that she can, you know, do things to them. It's not a male thing, but
right.
It's like it's a great thing.
I guess this is what I was getting around this way is when you speak of seeing a lot of the younger comics, they're up there, they're apathetic, and they
ironic detachment.
Ironic detachment. That's a great way to put it. I think that's a complete generation. I don't think that's just the comedy. I think that's
no, young. I think that's right.
That's young people.
That's the way they do it now.
That's the way they do it. Exactly. Exactly.
Well, it's the new version of like, you know, acting like a grown up or having your shit together when you really don't.
That's what they've picked. That's the trait they've picked.
Right. And I think it's always been prevalent. But like for me and probably for you, too, I always gravitated towards grown ups that were raw, that were weird, that were talking about real shit that made me a little uncomfortable. And I think that, you know, that's always sort of a rarefied that only a certain type of kid's going to seek that out.
Right.
And I think that my only issue with it could be an issue with comedy in general. It could be just by virtue of the fact that I'm older now, is that life in general and what people did with their lives when I was younger is different. You know, we were coming off the crashing wave of the 60s.
Okay.
You know, drug culture was still, you know, I remember going to high school when punk rock was introduced.
Right.
So there was this shift from, you know, pop music and metal and, you know, like in the, you know, the mythic 60s and 70s right. guys sort of like making way for this new, you know, new wave. You know, I saw disco, you know, fall apart. I saw, you know, new wave get integrated into the high school archetype thing. And then punk rock hadn't really integrated
yet. You've seen some shit, Mark.
Well, it's just, I think culturally, you know, with the rise of nerd culture, which is relatively new, that you know, these ostracized, intelligent, you know, sort of nuanced in a different way than I was. You know, like there is what is being called a sort of a nerd revolution, that their idea of what, you know, reality is and what life is very different. You know, I come from, you know, the world of chaos, and that, you know, going through two marriages, having a drug problem, you know, rock and roll, you know, punk rock and all this other shit, where it just seems like this whole generation's thing is like, we're smart, we're snarky, you know, we get it. And, you know, our life experience is not that interesting as our as our ability to sort of, you know, comment glibly.
Right, exactly.
On things we make up.
It's a generation of bloggers. It's whether it be verbal or, but that being said, that's obviously the liberal side of it. Those are the liberals. The nerd culture is a liberal culture.
Kinda. In a lot of ways, it's apolitical, because like the nerd culture is also, you know, a huge driver of the economic engine at this point. I mean, the guy who just sold YouTube made, you know, $1.5 billion.
Right.
So, I mean, in the sense that it is liberal, yes, but, you know, is it, you know, a defining economic machine in this capitalistic society? Sure. You know, I can't determine a political posture in a lot of the comedy that I hear. It's taken for granted that most comics are liberal.
Okay. Well, there are also certain things that I feel like with the rise of technology, like data mining in Facebook, anytime under music you enter in a band you like, you know, there are literally robot computer machines or whatever these marketing companies hire. That's how Facebook makes its money, is they search and they find out, okay, this many people like, you know, the Rolling Stones in the new Levi's commercial, throw in the Rolling Stones, boom.
Right, so you're saying that, you know, the culture that spawned nerd culture is now deciding how to perfect marketing, how to perfect the economic machine that is capitalism, that defines our country and our world's political and economic system.
No, what I'm saying is it's very annoying to me that the majority of people think they're counterculture.
Counterculture has been appropriated completely and then resold. You know, that's why, you know, you when you do alt comedy shows, it's not ethnically diverse. It's not even diverse in age, and everybody's wearing the same glasses frames and everybody likes the same music.
It's white kids that look like Brian Jones. And
Yeah, some of those, and then also white kids that look like, you know, Buddy Holly, and you know there's
right.
There's the mod look, and then there's the nerd look, but they're in the same spectrum. Okay.
Yeah, and it's very, I guess I'm a part of this generation. I'm somewhat ashamed of it, and I it's not my place to be ashamed of it. It's not my I'm not responsible for anyone. You know, it's not. I realize that, but okay, as someone that you're of an earlier generation, is that a normal thing? As in, did you look around at your generation when you were coming? I mean, I'm sure you did, and said like, oh, this is bullshit. Or were you aware something important was going on? Or is that in hindsight? When you talk about the punk rock, were you like, this is fucking punk rock? Am I going to look back and say like, yeah, I was a part of that?
I wasn't a part of it. That's the weird thing, is that, you know, I was too busy trying to figure out who I was. So a lot of those things are just hats we try on to find our own identity eventually. You know, I had to go back to punk rock. So I think
I don't know what this hat means.
Yeah, that's all right. But yeah, but it's a signifier
yeah,
of a generation.
Quite literally trying on different hats.
But that's true. And I think that, you know, that's part of youth, and that's, and how long that goes on for you to get to your own identity, and how those things inform what you eventually settle on is just part of growing up. And, you know, in terms of comedy, you know, I've gotten a lot less invested in, you know, what it, you know, what is the importance of it? It comes and goes, and, you know, and comedy is only relevant for short windows of time. And, you know, the shelf life of any comedian is not that long, really.
Right.
So, you know, and usually you're speaking to a, you know, a generational trend or a cultural trend if you're part of a group, and that's what you're seeing. You know, a lot of these guys and girls will go on to, you know, make careers in show business, design cartoons, do computer work, maybe do TV shows or whatever. I just think that the import we put on it, you know, in relation to what is real comedy, what isn't real comedy, you know, what was it used to be like, whatever. These are just cultural trends.
But I think, in a weird way, I mean, you're can I say newfound popularity? Is that a weird thing to say? Or I mean, you're blowing up. You're getting a lot of work right now. You're
doing all right.
Yeah, but you have a lot of listeners. You're you're sort of hailed as some sort of comedic hero amongst several comics you don't respect. But I feel
it's only, you know, the only reason that people like me in some, what I, you know, because I could never quite figure it out, why am I put in this place? I mean, I've been a pretty marginal character for a long time, okay. Even in the alt comedy world. It wasn't like those people gravitated towards me. You know, it was, you know, I seem to represent something, you know, sort of different for that world. You know, I'm a very, you know, raw. There's not much difference between me on stage and off stage. You know, right. I talk about my life in a fairly personal way. It's not always incredibly funny. There's not always punchlines, but it's always pretty raw and pretty honest. And that, you know, as an audience member, it feels pretty intimate. They don't get the sense that, you know, I'm a puppet of some kind or some caricature of myself. So I've always seen that, you know, I represent a kind of emotional volatility that, you know, in the spectrum of things that is unique. So I find that most people that respect me, it's only because of my honesty that I bring to it, and that like I seem to be relatively real.
Do you notice, I guess last night when I went to see CK last night, most of the people in the audience were my age. Every time I've seen you, most of the people, and this is a young town. I don't see old people in LA. I don't know where they are.
Right.
But most of the people I've seen in your audiences are my age. Okay. My generation, me performing for people my age, they don't get me. The people that come up after me, they're baby boomers, the people that like my stuff.
People my age?
Yeah. I mean, are you a boomer? Would you consider yourself a boomer?
Tail end.
Yeah.
Not really.
Okay. Fair enough. But do you think there's a generational disconnect? I mean, you say that you came up, you were listening to a lot of Pryor. Is that a disconnect? Because when I... and performing for people my own age, I think one of the reasons they might not be into it is perhaps that they knew me in high school. You know, not them in particular, but they get it.
Yeah, some people are deeper, some people are more intense, some people make people uncomfortable. You're a guy that's going to make people uncomfortable just by virtue of your own discomfort. You're intense. You're confronting things in yourself and the world around you. And, you know, that's not everyone's idea of entertainment. I mean, you know, a lot of times people want to see people that, you know, that don't deal with that stuff, but are just snarky and entertaining. So, I mean, I don't think it's a generational thing as much as it is a topic thing. And, you know, when people even like Louis or like myself, I mean, when you talk about grown-up stuff, you know, grown-ups will like you, and people who are younger will like your take on it if it's broad enough or out there enough for them to laugh at. But if they can't relate to it, it better be fucking, you know, like wacky enough or fucking dark enough for them to get something out of it.
Okay.
But, you know, a lot of times you're talking to a group of people like, I don't know what he's talking about. I haven't been married twice. I don't know what he's talking about. I've never gone broke. I don't know what he's talking about. I've never had to, you know, face death. Whatever the fuck it is. I've never been addicted to drugs.
Right.
So, you know, if you're just relating those things in an experiential way, people who haven't had that experience are going to be like, nah, not for me. But if you relate those things in an experiential way and you take it way over the top, then they're like, but that part was funny. It's really a presentation thing. You're dealing with children.
Right.
So if you're going to talk about what it's like to be a grown-up, you know, it better be, you know, easily processed by children, you know, at least in a funny way, for them to get something out of it, or else you're just going to be like, you know, what's the professor talking about? Yeah, so it's I don't know if it's generational as much as it is stylistic.
But do you think people of your own generation, do you have many fans that are of your, do you notice they're younger?
I'm always I'm noticing a lot of different people. In the sense that, like, you know, I have people that like my politics, and I have people that understand my aggravation because of my wiring mentally. I also am attracting a lot of people. Like, I had this experience in Bloomington where the guy said, you know, you did pretty well selling tickets, but I got to be honest with you, yeah, during your run, we sold more single tickets than I've ever sold. Well, what I'm finding is there's a lot of people that are, you know, that are kind of isolated people. A lot of people come to my shows alone, and they come because, you know, they hear their voice in their head, you know, in me talking. So that's kind of interesting to me.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, so it's varied, but I do have a lot of, you know, old hippies. I got a lot of people that like the style that reminds them of a comedy that they used to enjoy. They like the rawness of it or the honesty of it. And then I get the younger people that are just, you know, blown away by that, but it's taken a long time for them to find me. I'll tell you that.
Yeah. How long you been at it?
Well, I told you earlier, I mean,
we'll get to the James Lipton shit and we'll wrap it up, I guess.
Okay. Well, I mean, like, you know, the first time I went on stage was in college in the mid 80s. And then, you know, I committed my life to it when I graduated in 87. And that's.
Do you do it because you do you think you do it because you have to? I mean, I don't mean to sound too idealistic, like I was born into this. I don't mean it like that. But
I never thought about it as a business.
Okay.
I never thought about it as a means to some other end.
I connect with that. Yeah.
I just wanted to be a good comic because I really thought that to me it was like, you know, I can say what I want and I can find I can find my point of view, you know, and I can express myself. And the only context is I have to be funny. But outside of that, I can do whatever the fuck I want. So to me, it's just been an ongoing conversation and sort of an ability for me to, you know, to seek a mutual understanding with a broader group of people, and also to basically, you know, try to understand and be understood.
Yeah.
But now, like, you know, in terms of my recent success, not to jump your whatever.
No.
Is that, you know, what I'm finding now out of, you know, having been humbled by life and disappointed.
Right.
And through some shit in a real way. That, you know, my sense of entitlement, my sense of immature arrogance, and my sense of righteous bitterness is dissipating. And I'm now returning back to some place I was where I was younger, where, you know, I want to talk to other people. You know, I want to listen to other people. I want to be entertained. You know, I want to open up my heart enough to see that, you know, not everybody is a threat to me.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the opportunity that the podcast that gives me is a chance to, you know, engage my peers in conversation and to, because I believe comics are thinkers and most of us are very sensitive and most of us are very bright and most of us have time to think about a broad amount of shit and have good stories. And also to give back to the community that has, you know, given me my life. You know, so, you know, if there's any, you know, following along those lines, it's because, you know, I was first and foremost a fan of comedy. Comedy saved my life. You know, in the sense that, you know, when I was very young and I saw comedians, it made me laugh. And I was a heavy-hearted kid.
Yeah.
And I thought they were the greatest people in the world. And, you know, I've come back around to that after years of cynicism, entitlement, you know, anger, you know, disappointment and rejection. You know, and now I've come out the other side of this and having had a life, but also realizing, like, you know, I used to love this stuff.
Yeah.
And I used to love people doing it. And I still do. I've spent most of my life in the back of comedy clubs watching
right.
guys stand in front of walls, in front of microphones. And, you know, I don't think twice about it. But now, like, I really am able to enjoy it again.
Getting to the real shit, Mark. We're getting real.
Mm.
This just got real.
You feel it?
Shit just got real, man.
It sure does.
Stop touching me. What do you think creates your self-awareness? I mean, that's it. When people describe Mark Maron, I say self-aware. Frighteningly self-aware.
Well, I think fear creates it. And also the fact that, you know, if you're uncomfortable, you know, there's a difference between, like, you know, being lost in your head, being completely self-centered and being self-aware is that, you know,
you're also self-centered.
Right. But, you know, you as a self-centered person, we're wired that way. So, you know, you push enough people away, you cause enough trouble in your life, you get enough negative results.
Sure.
At some point you got to go, Jesus, what am I doing?
I know.
So yeah,
I know, buddy.
That's where that comes from.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
how'd I fuck that up?
Yeah. Well, no, when I impress you enough and I get on your podcast, you'll find out all about my fucking sordid past.
Okay. Sounds good.
No, absolutely. Did you ever get a crush on your manager?
Well, I was managed by Dave Becky for a long time, so no.
No, you're manager now.
Well, I
yeah, I got a thing for the, I can't deal with it. I sat next to her at UCB one night. I couldn't deal with it. I've got a British thing.
I don't have that, but I like her, and I don't have a crush on her. Don't shit where you eat.
No, no, I agree. Don't shit where you eat.
I mean, don't fuck where you work.
Okay. Which could be don't shit where you eat.
She's married and lovely and has been very good to me, and I respect her.
Are you seeing anybody?
Sure.
You are?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. I think I know the story there. Is it going well?
I'm dating aggressively. Yeah, yeah. And you know, I don't know that I've fully recovered from the heartbreak that was my last marriage. I'm not that emotionally available for a big relationship. And that makes it even, you know, that makes it more difficult because I realize like, well, I probably have to stop dating entirely and work some issues through, you know, dig a little deeper, get more self-awareness. And try to open the heart again in that area.
It's terrifying.
It is.
It's absolutely terrifying.
Because I've never done it properly.
Me neither, Mark.
Okay. Well, we can share that together.
All right, let's go play some Beatles songs. Thanks so much, man.
It was great talking
to you,
Jesse.
No, dude, it really, you know, I really enjoyed it.
I did too. It was
all right,
fun.
Cool. Thanks a ton. Knows not where he's going to. Isn't he a bit like you? Well, there you have it.
Another big thanks to Mark Maron. I think the interview went well. I think, or the discussion rather. I think shit got real. It's something I always encourage on the podcast. So here's the deal: Bukkake Circus. We made it. It's done. You can see it. Go to funnierdie.com. Type in Bukkake Circus, or you can go to pajorno.com. That's pjorno.com. Don't go there at work. Not safe. But my animator friend, Mark Allender, that's his website. He's got a lot of other stuff you can watch. And I interviewed him. He was on the last episode. So go back, check it out. You know, listen to some backlogs if you're a new listener. And next week, Montreal episode. That's all I have to say. Thanks, everybody. Godspeed.